Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, and welcome to a special seasonal episode of A Stab in the Dark, UK TV's chart-topping podcast that delves into the murky depths of crime fiction and TV crime drama. Just when I thought we were winding up for the end of the year, I was unceremoniously bagged up like a Christmas turkey and dragged back into the studios, just so we could present more crimey goodness for your listening pleasure. My name's Mark Billingham, and I'm delighted to say that today I'm joined by the fabulous Chris Marshall. You might recognise Chris as the face of hit comedy series My Family, the film Love Actually, or even those BT adverts. And while we'll touch on those early years as a comedy actor, I'm a bit more interested in his time as D.I. Humphrey Goodman in the ever-popular crime drama Death in Paradise. We'll find out more about Chris's career, the trials and tribulations of filming on a Caribbean island, and what it's like to work with my wife. Yes, that's what I said. And right at the end, I'll ask him for his top book and TV recommendations, just in time for your Christmas lists. Unless you're listening to this in July, that is. If that's the case, you may just want to look them up yourself. Welcome to A Stab in the Dark. Welcome to the podcast, Chris. Now, you've been in Death in Paradise for 3 series now. It's been going for 5 in total. So I guess the first thing I should ask you is, why do you think it's remained so hugely popular? What keeps drawing in these millions of viewers every series?
It is really no mistake of scheduling by the BBC that they place it right slap bang in the middle of probably the most depressing time of the annual calendar, and that being sort of January after the festivities of New Year and the overindulgence of Christmas has finished, and everyone is A, broke, B, cold, and C, back at work. And D, looking on the internet to book holidays. There's summer holidays, rather. And I think that is part of it. So why is it popular? I think it's what I call murder with nice hair.
Right.
I think it's quite cross-demographic. I think it's interesting for the whole family. I think it's one of those sort of, across-the-rainbow shows that can... You know, Dad can sit down and under the auspices of working out what the crime is, you know, have a look at the nice ladies on screen. The wife can, get her sleuthing hat on, and the kids can enjoy the comedy of the cat from Red Dwarf. I mean,
what else do you want?
What more do you want?
Not to like?
On a cold January.
But aside from the show, I mean, I hadn't realised that thing about... I mean, is there an upswing? Does the tourist industry in the Caribbean kind of see an upswing after every series goes out?
Well, I couldn't speak on behalf of the whole Caribbean tourist industry, obviously. I think they enjoy quite bullish bookings at the best of times. But for Guadeloupe, the island we film on, their bookings and tourist infrastructure building and all that kind of stuff has gone up exponentially. We film in a very small part, arguably the most beautiful part of the island, which is quite a big island. It's one of the biggest islands on that string of the Lesser Antilles. One side is quite flat, quite sort of savanna-like, quite sort of pastoral and arable. And the other side is very verdant, lush, virgin rainforest and volcanoes. Are sort of arguably original Caribbean, really.
Right.
Or original French West Indies. And it is a wonderful place. It's absolutely beautiful to live and film there.
You just said you're not really a spokesman for tourism, but you could easily be. Maybe
that's my future role. we have noticed whilst we've been filming over the last sort of four series I've done, a massive influx of foreign visitors, obviously from the UK.
Right.
Whereas before we never had anyone from the UK. I mean, French West Indies, apart from maybe St. Bart's, isn't really on the sort of radar of British tourists.
I'd like to think there's the odd one, the odd holidaymaker there, who's so kind of gripped by the whole concept of the series that they get there and then they spend the whole time looking around going, I don't like the look of him. Oh, he's a victim. He's next. Yeah. You know these people that always volunteer to move into Coronation Street whenever somebody moves out? There are people that take it a little bit too seriously.
The idyllic equivalent of Murder on the Orient Express.
You know? Now, I'm going to talk a bit later to you about the specifics of filming on Guadeloupe, but it's such a hugely watched show. You must get a lot of kind of recognition in the street now as Humphrey. I mean, people kind of waving, hello, Humphrey, or whatever it is.
I'm very fortunate to have been a part of a few sort of fairly big shows during my time, but this one really is something else. I think there's something about the nature of crime dramas that really captures people's imagination, especially with the books now. There are books that the creator of Death in Paradise, Robert Thorogood, writes with the characters from Death in Paradise. Not my character as of yet. And I think that people really sort of buy into that whole Cluedo-ness of the thing, you know, and it's sort of the whole Miss Marple-esque sleuthing.
That character, I mean, obviously you don't have to like a character to play a character. It's not always the way. But do you like Humphrey? Is he someone you'd go and have a drink with? I mean, where would you take him?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've always played him as someone not a million miles away from me. I do like him, yeah. I think the clue's in his name, good man, Goodman. I think he's an honest gentleman. I think that with the series that's coming out, that we've just finished filming, and series four for me and series six overall in terms of the series, and will soon be coming to UK TV, I think that we see a different side to him, a bit more of a more expansive side to him than maybe necessarily we've seen before, which I really love playing. I found, because as an actor, you always wish for a more multi-layered character than necessarily an hour's show where you have to solve a crime and introduce all the characters and then have a 13-minute denouement, you know,
right
at the end, can necessarily allow you. So
you've got the arc of a whole series, well, a number of series to develop a character. I mean, you're still doing those things, and you're still this kind of empathetic, likable character at the heart of the story. But you've got room to kind of to stretch the character over a number of episodes, haven't you?
Yes, that's true. But also, you know, you are kind of limited by the things I've just said. You know, by those sort of, you know, by the 59 minutes that is a BBC hour. However, the last two series, especially. Our producers and our creator have tried to sort of, you know, not mess with the format, because I think that would be cheating our audience. But I think that within that template, there's enough room for nudging. And for example, you know, there's a denouement in this following series where, instead of normally having all the suspects in one room, you know, with the summing up of the case, which is the kind of sort of pastiche of Miss Marple, we completely turn that on its head. And so little things like that. And I mean, looking for different ways to murder people is really quite hard.
Quite fun, though.
It's
quite
great fun.
I mean, you say, you can nudge it, but you can't take liberties. There's not going to be an episode where Humphrey falls on his head, bangs his head, and the whole episode is a dream, or, you know, there's aliens coming. I mean, you can't, you know, there's only so much you can do when you've got a format that is so wildly popular, right?
Yeah, I think someone told me when I was a very young actor, and nothing to do with this show or any show, really. I was in theatre at the time. And I think someone told me that you can play with an audience, but you can never cheat them. They'll never forgive you.
Yeah.
I think that's very true. You know, yeah. I think that's very true for this genre as well.
Especially crime fans of crime fiction. You can't cheat them. They know the rules, and if you don't play by them, they get very stroppy very quickly.
They will find a new way of murdering you.
they know plenty. Well, that's a bit about the show and a bit about the character. But before we really get stuck into Death in Paradise, let's talk about your career a little bit. You started off in comedy roles with My Family, Love Actually, and you won the British Comedy Award for Best Newcomer in 2002. Has comedy always come naturally to you? Has that always been your kind of first instinct, a comedic one?
It's kind of funny you say that. I mean, I was very much a straight actor, or considered myself a straight actor, when I was in theatre before I even broke into TV and films, or was fortunate enough to break into TV and films. I was always maybe a rather boyish, sort of feckless.
Was that what you said in Spotlight? There'd be your picture underneath. Boyish and feckless.
Yeah, it's a special skills, amongst others.
And horse riding.
Yeah, and roller skating, yeah. juggling. That's omnipresent, that is, juggling.
Does every actor have to juggle at some point? A few circus skills? Everybody has to do some of that.
I think
they
had to. I'm not sure. I think it's a sort of a bygone of the power of equity, I think, from the old days.
Well, an actor friend of mine once told me that the trick is that whenever you're asked if you can do something, you just say yes, because you can always learn it later.
Of course.
Can you fence? Yes. Can you speak Swahili? No problem. And then you learn it later.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. The golden rule is never say no. Never shut that door on you.
Well, I think you've said in the past, you said, I consider myself as a serious actor with a funny face and good timing. Mm. I've done a lot of serious stuff that people don't recognise me for. But now you've done a lot more serious roles. Do you feel a bit less pigeonholed in that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think in many ways, I think there's two ways you can look at it. You can say, look, I've been pigeonholed and I don't like it. Or you can look at it in the way of pigeonholing someone is actually a different way of saying you've found your a niche, your corner, and you're protecting it. And people say, when they're looking for a character who's in that corner, they go, "Get me that guy." You know, that's the guy we want, or someone a bit like that. You know, so if you're, I don't like to see it as being pigeonholed, because I always consider all of my characters, and some people disagree with me, but I would always consider all my characters to be ever so slightly different, because they are different people and have different MOs and different sort of, you know, backstories.
That thing of when you're known for comedy, I mean, I used to work many years ago as a stand-up, and that thing that happens when after a show, somebody would be buttonholing you at the bar, and they get really quite offended that you're not being funny.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, you go, well, I'm not working now. Mm. And they think you're a miserable bugger because you're not constantly sort of,
you're
not
always
all the time.
On, yeah. The other day, someone stopped me in the street. I'm trying to get my daughter into a car seat. She's 11 months old.
Right.
Trying to get my daughter into a car seat. She's absolutely having a Hiroshimic meltdown, you know, of massive proportions. And not about this getting into this maxi cosy or other car seats.
Other car seats are available.
Other car seats are available. I'm juggling my son as well, who's trying to play with his toys and get him in the car, get his seatbelt on. And this woman comes up to me and says, "Oh, can I have a selfie?"
Great timing.
Brilliant
timing. Her timing's even better than
mine. Her timing is even better than mine. Absolutely brilliant timing. I mean, the look I gave her, she's like, "Oh, all right. He's not very nice, is he?"
Yeah. You're not as nice as you are on that Caribbean murder mystery thing.
Oh, yeah. I thought you'd be all smiley and, yeah. You know, I live a real life as well.
Yeah. But you moved from My Family to things like Funland and Murder City, which were, you know, decidedly darker. Was that just kind of an accident? Was that just the way it happened, or was that kind of a deliberate attempt to try and do things that were, you know, very different in tone?
I think it was a mixture of both, actually. I think that in reality, when you were younger, you know, you have these big ideas about what you want to be when you're a young actor and stuff like that, and you don't like to get pigeonholed.
Yeah.
and you know, you don't and you want to move on in different ways, but then the realities of, you know, being a young actor and the fact that there's always someone coming up on your shoulder and all that kind of stuff, you know, it's a mixture of both. I think, you know, it's a mixture of the reality of the business and the fact that it is a hard business to work in, and you want to keep yourself current and keep yourself you know, not ubiquitous, but, you know, available and around, and, you know, in the public eye. But also, you don't want to carry on doing the same thing, otherwise you just choose an office job. So it's a sort of mixture of both, really. I mean, I was Murder City was definitely a decision to try and move away from the rather crazy inane son in, you know, in a family sitcom.
Mm.
But albeit with a sense of a modicum of humour, but darker humour. Fanland was another decision, you know, to move even further away from that. And I had an amazing time working on Fanland and the guys from Jeremy Dyson, the League of Gentlemen guys, Mark Gatiss. I mean, Love Actually was just it just a no-brainer. You know, do you want to do a film with an alumni of
right.
enormous British and American film stars?
People don't tend to go, I'll get back to you on that.
Yeah, yeah, but the character, is it going to be... No, I'll do it, please. Yeah, thank you very much. Ironically, I think we all of us only did about 12 days filming each on that film, and it's one of those films that just... It seems like we worked on it for years, but we only did 12 days filming on it, and it's sort of... That really is a ubiquitous film. I mean, it is, you know, it's...
And I'm sure it'll be shown again this Christmas.
I'm sure it will.
Of course
be.
It will. So then along comes Death in Paradise. Was it a show you were aware of or a fan of before you went up for the part?
I was aware of it. My wife was a fan of it. My wife is actually a fan of the genre. She's a big fan of, Poirot, Marple, Hetty Wainthrop.
Hetty Wainthrop Investigates.
Wainthrop, yes, thank you. She was a big fan of all that. That she loves a good crime drama. So she had watched it, and I had seen it in passing because we filmed during our summer for it to be transmitted during the winter. So I was around February when the second series was going out, I was in the process of auditioning for replacing Ben.
Right.
Ben Miller, and so I watched the whole of the second series,
right.
And became a bit of a fan of it then. But my wife was quite a big fan of the show before that, and an even bigger one in the second series, and a little bit of one in the third, fourth, and fifth.
Lots more to come from Chris, but first let's segue seamlessly to a Stab in the Dark's undercover reporter, Paul Hirons, as he catches up with the actor who Chris Marshall replaced in Death in Paradise, Ben Miller.
Of course, before Chris's Humphrey Goodman, there was Ben Miller's Richard Poole, a stuffy, suit-wearing lover of bureaucracy who set the fish-out-of-water English man abroad template that has made Death in Paradise such a success. Earlier this year, we spoke to Ben about Richard Poole when he was promoting Death in Paradise on UK TV's Drama Channel. He started off by telling us about Richard, his lovable foibles, and what makes him a brilliant detective.
Richard Poole, well, his heart's in the right place. He's very honourable, he's a very, very honourable man. Cannot really judge other people's emotions. The thing I really loved about him as a character and was kind of one of my secrets that I had was Richard can't tell when somebody's telling the truth, which is why his partnership with Camille is so important, because Camille is very intuitive and emotionally literate and all those things that Richard isn't. One of my favourite things that we used to do, and it's I don't know that it's ever captured in the series, is that Camille would give me little nods. I would look to her to know whether someone was telling the truth. This makes him a brilliant detective, because he has no idea whether anyone's telling the truth. He has to ask them very specific questions. He's also insensitive to their emotional state. So you might have just lost a relative, a refuse truck might have just backed over your relative and they've been, you know, banged over the head and tumbled back into a wheelie bin and then compacted by some sort of rubbish compactor. And Richard will have he'll basically have no compassion whatsoever. He's not uncompassionate. And if someone says to him, you know, they've just had their relative, you know, they've just had their, his brother was just killed, compacted. Oh my God, I'm so sorry. He's a good person. He just simply cannot tell. He can't judge people's emotional states and he doesn't know whether they're lying or not.
So Richard Poole there, a good person, but a bit socially challenged. Now, whenever anyone talks about Death in Paradise, people want to know what it's really like filming for 6 months in Guadeloupe. Chris is going to talk about it in a little while, but here's Ben telling us what it's really like filming in, well, paradise.
So this house was a build, actually. I mean, in the story, he inherits it from the previous incumbent detective inspector on the island. And it's just amazing. So it's on this fantastic stretch of beach on Basse-Terre, which is the volcanic island. It's this beautiful stretch of sort of, I'd say, fawn-coloured sand. It's not white sand. You get white sand. The white sand beaches in the show are on the other island, Grande Terre. And when you see the brown sand beaches, those are on the volcanic island. and it just faces straight out to sea, but it's a very, there's a very shallow run out on the beach. So you can run into the water for, you know, you can run into the water for a good 100 yards. I really wanted to spend the night. I mean, I really wanted to spend the night there, you know, and actually stay there. Unfortunately, the taps don't work. I mean, it's not a real place. There were always people who once said, I wouldn't mind living in the shack at night, you know, and I'll be cleared out for filming in the morning. But unfortunately, it doesn't quite work. You know, doesn't quite work. It is a set, but it's just the most fantastic set. Beautifully designed, so there's just this fantastic picture window at the end where you can see this perfect Caribbean view. And do you know, one of our main concerns about that set was the view through the window looks so perfect. We were worried that people would think it was CGI. That's not CGI. There's no CGI in the show, actually. That view through the window of that beach is the view through the window in that shack.
Sounds like a really tough life, but it turns out that Ben isn't as much of a stickler for rules as his character was.
I remember at one point we were having a... We sort of all arrived at the beginning of, for one season's filming, I think it was the second year that we made the show, and there was a big party on the beach, and everyone was sort of chatting and stuff, and I just thought... I'll just wander down and, you know, and just go and paddle in the, you know, just have a little, take my shoes off and just paddle. And there was a sign I could see. It said, you know, swimming forbidden or whatever it was in French. And I just thought, oh, God, so stuffy, aren't they? You know, so everything's so health and safety. And I just wandered into the sea. And I kid you not, I went up to about my knees in the water, and it was like somebody grabbed me around my ankles and pulled me underwater by this current. And then it started pushing me out into the bay. So I sort of started to panic. And it was everybody on the beach just sort of, you know, toasting one another. And it was that classic thing. I was going, ah, hey, people, a couple of people sort of waving. I really thought I was going to get drowned. Before I've even begun, I'm going to be a victim, possible murder victim on my own show. Thankfully, somebody had been telling me at the hotel the night before, because we've been talking about this very beach, which is you don't try and swim back, you swim out. So then you swim out with the current and then round to the edge of the bay and then come in at the edge, because the riptides are all in the middle of the bay. So that's a tip. That's a good tip. You try and swim back in, you exhaust yourself. And that's when people sometimes get into difficulties. Just swim with the current, swim out to sea, swim around, and then come in at the edge of the bay.
So almost literally a death in paradise there. Thank goodness he survived. So that was Chris's predecessor, Ben Miller, talking about his time on Death in Paradise. Let's head back to Mark and Chris in the studio.
So, Chris, you placing Ben Miller in a hugely successful show,
yeah.
There must have been some pressure attached to that.
There was, actually. It did well in the first series. I think it got about 5.5 million series average, which is pretty good these days. But then it really started to take off in the second series. And I think the series average was about 7.98. These figures, don't hold me to these figures, but... But, it, I mean, 8 million for a show.
It's incredible in this day and age. Incredible.
And then Ben, obviously, you know... left, and I think there's something fatalistic about me that sort of quite like the idea that this could really go down in flames, you know, this could really go quite badly. But I knew I could do a bit of a job on it. I knew that I had something to give, I think, to the show, or at least I thought I did. Whether that was a misapprehension or not, very early on, I felt the pressure actually, because it wasn't just the pressure of, you know, taking over a show from, you know, someone as luminary as Ben and a successful show at that. But also, you know, a genre that people are quite fastidious about, quite passionate, thank you very much, yeah, passionate about. But also, you know, all the sort of the critics and the, you know, I mean, people say they don't read the critics, but it's very hard not to. You know, I was very aware of people's... you know, hopes and fears for my tenure and the show as a whole, everyone from the dear old auntie, BBC One, and all the way down to the viewer, you know, and Radio Times readers. But, I was
I thought I could do something with it, and really a really easy part of my sort of the transition for me and me getting into the show was the way I was welcomed by the crew and the cast. You know, at that point, it was apart from Ben, the completely original cast. Because I'm sure they were, you know, thinking, what's going to happen here? You know, what's this guy going to bring to the table? Is he going to be any good? Is he going to be different? You know, how is this going to work? Are we going to have any show left? You know, all these things which matter to an
actor.
Because
it's a big cast and crew who've been working on this every year. And if the show doesn't work, all those people are out of work. Well, I mean, it is a big, you know, you are responsible in a way for quite a lot of other people.
For me, I felt that pressure as well, you know. I didn't really want people to be getting an early bath, you know, just because of me. So, but they really made me feel welcome when they, you know, necessarily needn't have done. And within a couple of weeks, in series three, we actually shot the second episode first and the first episode second. So I actually had an episode to myself where I could just get my feet under the table without Ben sort of being there in the background, you know, the handover, you know, so to speak, and because Ben was obviously in the first episode of series three, there was an added pressure, you know, to really sort of be different and yet, you know, not upset the apple cart. So I had an episode to myself, which was really useful, actually, critical for me because it gave me it takes about 2.5 weeks to film one episode.
Right.
2.5 to 3 weeks to film one episode. And so I had a good three and a half weeks out there on my own. And just to get my head down, you know, sample the pitfalls as well of filming in the Caribbean.
I need to come on to the pitfalls. Yes. Because three, so you didn't upset the apple cart, and four series later, here we are. And I'm sure most people's reaction when they find out that you film this in the Caribbean and so on is, well, it's all right for some, mate. I know a little bit about this because I mentioned my wife at the top of the show, and in the interest of full disclosure, I should mention that my wife worked as a director on the series that is yet to go out, did a couple of episodes. She's always telling me how hellish hard work it is out there in the Caribbean. You know, I'd be talking to her on Skype, oh, nightmare this, nightmare that. Is she just saying that to make me feel better when I'm at home kind of cleaning up cat sick and emptying the bins? I mean, is it really that much hard work?
There is an element. It is extremely hard to work out there, and there is this caveat. It is extremely hard in a different way. We work incredibly long hours, and the heat is, because we film during hurricane season, it's not like the sort of Caribbean holiday that people think it is, you know, where it's December,
yeah,
you know, Christmas on the beach, you know, 28 degrees with a prevailing wind, you know. Rather beautiful and blue skies. It's very oppressive heat. The last week of my filming for me, it was 42 degrees.
Yikes.
Pretty hot. But it's not a sort of dry heat. It's an incredibly oppressive heat. There are mosquitoes everywhere. There is other wildlife.
Isn't there some hideous killer caterpillar? My wife was telling me about some really evil caterpillar that can really bite in a, you know, has a bite like a dog. Or maybe, again, this was making me feel better.
Is a caterpillar that isn't, because of my sort of quizzical look, there is a caterpillar which is quite poisonous, but he doesn't really bite like a dog.
Oh, all right.
But there is a centipede.
Oh, it's that centipede.
Poison centipede. Scalopendra, which is it's literally like a centipede that's been armor plated by the U.S. Army to survive nuclear winters.
Right.
It is mean. I mean, and everyone who comes out there says, "I'm pretty sure I saw a scalopendra last night." Yeah, it had millions of legs, and I was like, "No, that's a millipede." No. Well, all right. Well, what's it? Which one's a scalopendra? Trust me. When you see one,
you'll know it.
They're like browny red long bodies with legs like that. And I'm putting the legs at right angles.
Just the mime that Chris is doing at the minute, listeners. Like you really do not want to run into one of these things
like
on a dark
praying
night.
Mantis, and they move really quickly. And they can grow up to about a foot long. So about like that. And they're mean, and they pack a hell of a punch.
Do they get into like the villas and the hotel? Yeah. You have to like check your shoes and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, they're very prevalent in villas. The hotel where the crew stays, they're not so prevalent because it's right. It's on a sort of promontory, sticking out into the sea. So they're not particularly coastal. I don't know why they're not in the hotel. It's sort of one of those sort of bizarre.
They haven't
things.
Got a reservation.
They haven't got a reservation. The hotel's full, darling. Yeah. And if you're on a higher floor, they tend not to go. They tend to be ground floor dwellers. They don't like the lifts very much. But if you're in a villa, and a lot of the crew, the long-standing crew and, you know, cast are in villas, they are very prevalent. I mean, you see them a lot.
Wow. And the weather isn't always idyllic, is it? I mean, it's not,
God, no.
You know, there's my wife told me about one particular very hairy boat trip where they had to go across to Montserrat, which is a neighbouring island, but it's still, what, 45-minute boat ride away or something?
Quite a long boat ride.
A bit hairy by all accounts. So, I mean, you know, it like any filming, stuff can go wrong, stuff happens. I mean, it's not just one idyllic bounty commercial after another, is it?
No, and also we don't have the infrastructure to film out there either, so... One sort of thing that sort of started to happen with the film Death in Paradise is because it being a fairly small Caribbean island, we've done six series of this. We are kind of running out of locations on the island, you know, to film in that we haven't filmed before, to make it look new and interesting. And to do that, we've got to go further and further afield.
And what's it like when you come back after filming? I mean, you've got months and months out there.
Yeah.
What's it like when you get back and you get out of a... get off a plane at Heathrow and it's drizzling and you're back here, back to reality?
It's glorious.
Yeah?
It's glorious. It's glorious. And I go to the pub and I have a pint of Guinness and it's absolutely wonderful. A pint of stout, I should say. Any stout.
You're going to be getting an awful lot of free car seats free Guinness at the end. This goes out.
Yeah, what else? What do I really
need? Yeah, what do I really like? I'm starting to think about this now.
Christmas is coming.
I really think Aston Martins are wonderful cars.
We don't use one in the show, but I'm thinking we might next year.
Really? So it's good to be back.
So I go and have a nice cold drink, a pint in my local. There's a fire burning, and I get to wear a scarf for the first time and shoes for the first time in 6 months.
Yeah.
It's absolutely glorious, and I'm not worried about have I got my mosquito repellent on and all that kind of stuff. It is absolutely wonderful. Until I'm on the M4 about a week later, I'm stuck in traffic somewhere in between Reading and Newbury for absolutely no reason whatsoever. You know, probably because someone's lost a Murray Mint on the motorway or something like that. I don't know, something. You know, and I'm sat there thinking, why did I spend the last 3 months of filming in this idyllic Caribbean location, hankering after being in this cold, miserable country?
Yeah, grass is always greener. Now, you can see Death in Paradise weeknights at 8 p.m. on Alibi from the middle of December and throughout January, but Series 6 is just around the corner on the BBC. Now, obviously no spoilers, but can you tell us something about Series 6? What can we expect?
Well, we have a new series regular in Series 6, who is kind of connected to Humphrey's character. It is Humphrey's potential new love interest. Martha, played by the wonderful Sally Breton. She is a series regular, as I just said, which sort of tends to suggest that, you know, that Humphrey may be involved in a bit of a longer term relationship than, well, we've not seen him in any kind of relationship at all so far. But
viewers are going to love that. They love a bit. I mean, you know, they love the crimes, they love all that, but they like a little bit of, you know, complex emotional involvement and that sort of stuff.
Yes, and not only that, you know, with Humphrey Goodman, it being Humphrey Goodman, it really is not a foregone conclusion. This, you know, the path of true love never doth run smooth, and it certainly doesn't with Humphrey Goodman in Series 6 of Death in Paradise either. I mean, it really is... there's a lot of change. There's a lot of ups and downs in this series. It's a series I'm most proud of out of the four I've done, actually.
Great. Well, plenty there that viewers will be gagging for. So, but what's next for you? What's next for you, Chris?
Well, at the moment, I am in a realm of house husbandry at the moment. Because I had a daughter earlier this year, and unfortunately, because of one thing or another, including my son's nursery and Zika virus on the island where we were filming and the heat and my wife having been there for 3 years already, A number of factors meant that they couldn't travel with me this year, which is a bit of a shame because it was a long time to spend away from my newborn daughter. So having left my wife to basically single parent for most of the summer whilst I whooped it up in the Caribbean, should we say?
Whooped it up?
Whooped it up in the Caribbean, should we say, at least as far as she's concerned. The worm has well and truly turned, and I am now indulging in my own form of single parenting while my wife writes her new book. And I am looking after the kids when they wake up teething and dosing out Calpol willy-nilly here and there. I've just wanted some Calpol, so I just thought I'd say that.
Yeah, a lot of you also threw in Murray mints at one point there. So, I mean, we're expecting whole hampers. In each episode, we ask our guests to bring in their recommendations for a good read and a good watch. So, Chris, what have you read recently that you'd recommend to our listeners?
Well, and this is going to be a bit of a sort of an interesting one. It's a not very well-known book. I was reading something in one of the newspapers. I'm not going to name check them. I'm going to learn from my mistakes what's become of Jersey as an island, you know, since it became high finance, you know, and
since Bergerac ended.
Since Bergerac ended, and the financiers moved in, and they mentioned this book called about sort of private detective called Marigold Dark, who is trying to get to the bottom of some rather shady goings on in Jersey's financial establishment, and so I thought that would be quite an interesting read. So I got it, and it was a sort of self-published on Amazon by a wonderful writer called Paul Bisson. And that's what I read. The title is it's an eponymous, I think, book called Marigold Dark.
And Marigold Dark by Paul Bisson.
By Paul Bisson. It was a wonderful book. It's a hilarious and tragic in equal measure. I really loved it, and I would urge anyone to read it.
Okay, great. Thank you. And what about a TV crime drama?
Death in Paradise all the way. No, I mean...
Obviously Death in Paradise.
I mean, I'm a massive fan of the old crime dramas, and Rockford Files is one for me. I mean, I'm a massive fan of James Garner.
He died earlier this year.
He died
right,
early
one of
this
many.
Year. I was first introduced to him when I watched The Great Escape by my grandfather and my sort of late grandfather, and then, you know, as a child watching TV, I was always watching The Rockford Files, and I still watch them now. So I would always have to say The Rockford Files. I know it's not really new, and maybe it doesn't matter. I'm not really current on all these kind of things, so.
Form is temporary, class is permanent.
This is true.
And I'm sure The Rockford Files is available on box sets, or it's available on some channel somewhere. Go watch The Rockford Files. Well, that's about it for this extra special episode of A Stab in the Dark. We'll be back again sooner than you think, inviting more big names from the worlds of crime fiction and TV crime drama into our lair. You can find out more about A Stab in the Dark, along with articles and some great book competitions, at uktv.co.uk/astabinthedark. Or, if you have a recommendation for a guest or a topic you'd like to hear discussed, get in touch with us on Twitter using the hashtag #AStabInTheDark, or drop it in a review on iTunes, something like Best Podcast in History, or Bloody hell, that Mark Billingham sounds like a right sex god. You know the kind of thing. So with that, it's a huge thank you to my very special guest, Chris Marshall. Thanks to our producers, Sam Pearson, Paul Hirons, and Ashley Sullivan. My name's Mark Billingham. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.